Are you ready to take your poker game to the next level? Be sure to visit ProfessionalPoker.com to get the best in poker books and videos. ProfessionalPoker.com features all the titles from 2+2 Publishing, as well as all the best-reviewed books in the business. ProfessionalPoker.com carries the Expert Hold'em series of DVDs. These include Rolf Slot Boom, Winning Plays, 4-DVD set on No Limit Hold'em, Ed Miller's Limit, 4-DVD set, Byron Jacobs' Heads Up Hold'em, and Dave Fromm's Shorthanded Hold'em DVD sets. While browsing ProfessionalPoker.com, keep your eyes open for titles available as B-Stock. What are B-Stock? These are unread publisher's seconds or shipping ding store returns available at great savings. Become a better and more profitable player for less at ProfessionalPoker.com. Pull up a chair and relax. It's time for Poker Psychology with your host, Dr. Al Schoonmaker. Poker Psychology is brought to you by Hold'emRadio.com.
All right, I deliberately broke to give you a chance to think about that because I know a number of you are either pros or wannabes. So my two questions for Tommy we're going to ask him in order are, one, if you had it to do over again, would you become a poker pro, full-time poker pro? And then after that is, what advice do you have for the wannabes out there? And we got a bunch of them. Mm-hmm. Tommy, take the first one.
Well, I would definitely do it over again, despite all the pain and agony. Largely because I'm kind of free spirit. I was very attracted to the idea of not having an employee or employees or a service or a product or constraints on my time. And, of course, being, completely insanely hooked on poker, there was just simply nothing else I would rather do. So I have no regrets about, I can't really even say the path I've chosen. I think poker chose me. But in terms of, in my book, I have a section called Going Pro, and, the summary of the advice I give there is ancient, which is follow your dreams and follow your heart and don't screw anybody. I don't think that just because something is dangerous or just because it has a high probability of failing is a reason to not do it. For example, let's talk about the young up-and-comers, the poker scene. Yeah. You got a 21-year-old guy, and he wants to be a professional football player, or he wants to be a race car driver, and that's his passion, and he's got an aptitude at it, and he's worked at it. I say in my book, jump, go for it. I use the analogy of jumping off a cliff, and you're trying to fly, so you got these wings, and you might make it, and you might crash.
Tommy, the smart money's on falling.
Right. You might crash. Well, the high percentage of people are going to say. So that's what, from what I've read of your stuff,
yeah.
It's like there's such a high failure rate that they shouldn't even try. And I don't look at it like that. I'm like, is it better to have jumped and crashed than to have never jumped at all? And it depends on the person. But only each individual can know what they think they should do. But it's extremely painful. I'll give you that. It's extremely painful, dangerous occupation.
All right, now. But, Tommy, you came from another dangerous occupation, musician. I can tell you, one of the best movies I ever saw was called The Competition.
Oh, I love that movie.
Well, that was a wonderful film. It was about a man, apparently pianists can compete in
Richard Dreyfuss and Amy Irving, right?
We can't remember.
Yeah.
But only until they're a certain age, and then they're out of it.
Uh-huh.
And if you don't get established by the time it's over, you're finished. You go and you teach music someplace, or you punch tunes at Harry's bar. And it's really a painful world.
Well, it's possible to be happy punching tunes in Harry's bar. That's the thing.
Oh, okay. you're not unaccustomed to the insecurity of
not making any money and working your ass off. Yeah.
Yeah, right. I mean, you've been there, right? Yeah.
I sort of am attracted to careers where that happens. It could end up be that I might do much more writing in the future. And if that happens, I figured doing music. And I used to joke about how I wanted something that was more sure. So I'll go into the writing business.
Right. Oh, my God. I'd hate to tell you how much money I made out of my first 7 books or so. Yeah, I mean, it worked out that the time I invested in those books, I probably should have flipped hamburgers at McDonald's, all right? I've done okay on a couple of them, but some of them, and I might add, a couple of them got well-reviewed in the New York Times, but they still didn't make me any money. Okay, Tommy, now let's talk about somebody else. Somebody who's a college kid. He's a junior in college. He made $84,000 last year.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, maybe I ought to just say screw it and follow my dream.
Yeah.
What would you suggest to him?
Do it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Just do it.
Yeah.
Drop out of school.
Yeah. If he doesn't want to be in school, he should quit school. That's how I feel.
Okay. Let's make it harder. Let's take the guy who's making $75,000 a year in a job that it bores the crap out of him.
Well, he should quit no matter what, whether he's not, okay. Even if he's wait.
I'm going to make it harder for you.
Okay.
He's got a wife and two children and a mortgage.
That's different. See, when you add the outside responsibility, it's a whole different deal, a whole different game. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's just a different set of parameters. You know, it's a case-by-case thing. I mean, I would say he should take steps toward moving in another direction so that he can do something that he's passionate about, he likes, but he can't just quit his job.
Right. And that's one of the things that troubles me is some people don't have a transition strategy. They just say, I'm out of here. They often tell off the boss and burn the bridges.
Yeah,
and,
but there's really, see, if a guy's miserable, you got to look at, if you do like a balance sheet on his happiness, right? What's he going to do, get more miserable? No.
Okay.
Take a shot.
Okay, I'm going to jump forward now and talk about another area of the book. He's got a section on information, and I love this section because it's very consistent with a book I wrote a long time ago called Negotiate to Win, which says that the name of the game in negotiations is get as much and give as little information as you can. It's information reciprocality, whatever.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay? Although I didn't coin the term, all right? Uh-huh. In fact, it wasn't even original to me. What's your position on information?
Well, I talk, I write a great deal in the book about information, especially at table poker, which is means brick-and-mortar poker. And the idea here is that all information involves the movement of muscles. And so if one of your objectives is to send as little information as possible, one way to do that is to put your awareness on your actual physical body and take efforts and training to minimize the amount of motion. And that means that also includes your tongue in a big way.
So that's related to your advice to P. Garlic before, which is don't get involved because you'll be giving away information.
And you're getting emotionally involved. So it's a huge win to stay out of any conflict at the poker table.
Okay.
What I call Sixth Street is
Let me define Sixth Street. Sixth Street, I love Tommy. Is an original guy, and he came up. I haven't seen the term Sixth Street before. And I can't remember reading much about it. And I know I hadn't thought intelligently about it, frankly. And here's a quotation from it. It's right after Sixth Street starts when the betting stops. Sixth Street ends when no one is talking about the previous hand. Sixth Street usually finished by the time the next hand starts, although for some hands it can last for years. And that's certainly true. We're still talking about that fold and raise thing. But here's what he's like. Sixth Street is when players let their guard down as if all of a sudden it's safe to reveal classified secrets to the enemy. It's like they don't even know that the war is still going on. Mm-hmm. I love it. Tell us more, Tommy.
Well, if I had to attribute, you know, the sum of all the money I've made at poker and how much of it comes from actual betting skill and how much of it comes from other things, a great deal of it comes from information reciprocality, because I don't talk about poker hands or anything to do with poker at the table, and other people do. And so there's this constant stream of information coming into me and none coming out, and that translates to dollars.
Let me tell you a variant on that. The most common conversation in poker is bad beat stories. And every time you tell a bad beat story, you are giving away information that's going to come back and bite you in the ass. because you have told somebody, here's how I play my hand. Mm-hmm. Here's how I think about this hand.
Right.
And he's just sitting there saying, oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
And if he's any kind of a player, he's recording all of that,
right.
And he's going to hit you in the head with it without your even knowing it. Okay. You made an unusual position in topic 100, game selection. You wrote, if while you are playing, you are attached to the notion that you are a better player than any or of all of your opponents, or you're a worse player than they, that's bad news for your game decisions, selection decisions, and your betting decisions. I found that surprising because, I mean, everybody and his brother, including me, have written that game selection is the critical factor, that if I sit down in a game where I'm the best player, I'm probably going to win. And if I sit down in a game where I'm the worst player or one of the worst players, I'm probably going to lose. And you're saying not to do that?
Yes. I draw a distinction between the word judge and evaluate. Okay? So the idea is what you want to do is let me restart that. If you have an idea of your in your head of you're better than that player. Right, and how you are doing, or you know, how good you are, how bad they are, and something changes. If you're attached to a certain idea of how you think things are, and something changes, then your evaluation is always going to be wrong as soon as anything changes. And so the next paragraph here is about evaluating in the moment. So if you're attached to I'm a good player, I'm a bad player, that's about the past and the future. Right. What you want to do, if you want to do good game selection, is at every single instant in the game, you need to be able to evaluate the current standing. Their tilt changes, your tilt changes, this changes, he's tired, that's tired. So if you played with a guy last week and you think, I'm better than him, well, tonight he might be better than you. So the idea is that you have to evaluate in the moment all the time.
Okay, but still, I know that if I walk in, I live in Las Vegas. I play moderate stakes. Small, no-limit games, 1-2, 1-3, 2-5. And I know when the very first thing I do is I walk around because there's four games there. And this one over here has three guys that I know are good.
Right.
And this one over here has a bunch of drunken tourists.
Right.
I'm going to go with the drunken tourists because
right.
I am better than them.
Right.
I don't care how long, you know, I can play my C game and I'm still
yeah.
better than them.
In that sense, you know, looking at it in that context, then the excerpt you wrote just doesn't apply.
Okay.
All right. The excerpt you read.
All right, because I agree that we don't want to make the mistake of saying I'm better than him based upon a small sample of data. For example, I saw somebody last week, and he was on tilt, and I didn't know he was on tilt because I got there late.
See, I take issue with the word better. I would say what you want to say is just evaluate it, right? You would look at the game and you say, I rate to make money in this game, and stay away from the judgment. Just stay with the evaluation and try to stay away from the judgments.
Okay, we're getting close to the end. We've got to talk about what the central theme of his book is, quote, how to play poker painlessly. Painlessly?
Well,
let me tell you about the bad beat. I imagine he actually did it. It was terrible.
Okay. It can be done.
Okay, well.
That's what the whole last section of the book is about, elements of performance.
Right.
How to really do it. And the key to eliminating pain is recognizing that the cause of the pain is your thinking. And so if you can take control of your thinking and literally, and I mean absolutely literally, stop the thinking and focus all your energies on only what's going on around you, the pain ceases to exist.
Ceases to exist?
Ceases to exist.
You mean when they crack my aces, it's not going to hurt so much?
It'll hurt. No, here's how. Al. It will hurt. It'll cease to exist until you start thinking again, and then it'll come right back.
Oh, all right. I knew there was a catch to it. So Percodan doesn't work.
It's not easy, but it can be done.
Okay. All right. We're almost out of time. I'm going to ask a couple of things. There is absolutely no question in my mind that Tommy's book is going to be controversial. There are going to be people who love it. there are going to be people who hate it. And Tommy's sitting right here, and he knew I was going to say this because it is different. It is fundamentally different from any poker book, and there are lots of people who are going to say, you're messing with the Bible, babe, you know? What do you think people are going to say positively and negatively about the book and about you?
Well, what I'm trying to do with the book is reach the people who will be reached by it. You know, it isn't going to speak to everyone. I don't expect it to. But what I found from the feedback I've gotten from my previous writing and from my coaching, that there are certain lessons and messages in here that resound deeply with some people. And that's basically, so I'm not really too worried if it isn't wildly popular or if there are a lot of people that... resist it or reject it, because I do believe that it will touch some people deeply.
Okay, just by chance, I submitted my article, part three of Are You Emotionally Ready to Win? And it'll be out in Card Player in 2-3 weeks. And it said something like this: the subject of emotional control is dealt with in my own book, in Zen and the Art of Poker by Larry Phillips, which is a very, very different kind of
book. Yeah.
Some people love it, some people hate it, and in Elements of Poker. We also referred to some academic works like The Self-Control Handbook, edited by Professor So-and-So. Emotional control is central to you. How come?
Because I'm terrible at it. And I had I had to get over it, or else I was going to have to quit playing poker. You know, I played at the beginning in games that were so unbelievably loose that all I had to do was get a hold of Sklansky and Malinow's book in 1987 and do something like their hand charts, and I was going to make enough to live on, period. So my only demon was myself, and I had plenty of demons, and so it was so critical to my welfare and my survival that it became my biggest hurdle.
All right, so let me see if I understand you. You had to cope with the demons, and this taught you how to help other people to cope with their demons.
Well, yes, I had to cope with my demons. Then I started teaching about coping demons, and the act of teaching made me better at the act of teaching about coping with demons.
Okay, and I have to say that there are, here in Las Vegas, 10,000 reasonably competent poker players who are not doing remotely as well as they should because they haven't got control of their demons.
Well, I would say it could, not should, but yes.
Okay, they're just out there. They come up to me all the time because I'm a psychologist, and they want to tell me, and they're talking to the wrong guy because I'm really not a therapist, and I'm sure as hell not a handholder. I'm saying, and if you're upset about the donkeys, well, that's too goddamn bad, sir. You got to learn how to handle the upset, because I can't change the donkeys. And absolutely standard conversation between psychologists is, I can't do anything about them. I can only help you to do on you. All right, Tommy, last question. What would be the one piece of advice that you would most want our listeners to remember?
Well, it's in the it's at the end of the book, and it's primarily about taking care of yourself, you know, and being good to yourself. And this is the start of and the seed that can lead to profit and welfare and poker and everything else. And so my book does tie into, can be thought of at the end as a metaphor for life, using very directly use poker as a metaphor of life lessons. And so that is the final life lesson of my book, is just take care of yourself every day as best you can.
Okay. I think some of you out there want more information about this. Unfortunately, Tommy's book isn't going to be out for a few days or a few weeks. We don't know.
A few months.
All right. But you can get one hell of a lot of information at TommyAngelo.com. I encourage you to go there. Wow. I'm out. I'm done. Goodbye. Our engineer fell asleep. I think he's drinking again.
No, I'm chatting with Brian Devonshire. He's asking for some stuff in here in chat.
Folks, okay.
Poker Psychology with Dr. Alan Schoonmaker and our special guest, Tommy Angelo. Be sure to join us next week, same time, same station.
Linda Johnson and Jan Fisher.